You're listening to a special presentation of Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. As 2019 winds down, we're taking a look back at some of our best interviews, some challenging conversations, and some illuminating storytelling. And today, we're going to revisit an interview we did with Marlene Trump back in August, 1 month after she became the 7th president of Boise State University. When Idaho State Board of Education announced that she would be the next leader of the institution and the first woman to hold that post, students, faculty, and staff in the crowd, well, they erupted in applause. And since then, she has had her hands full working to serve Boise State students coming from all corners of our state. Let's listen back now to that conversation with Dr. Trump. So I want to talk just about you first, because you grew up in Wyoming, in Green River. I've actually driven through it before.
A lot of people say that.
Right? It's on I-80. What was it like growing up in a small town, but also in a situation where no one in your family had ever gone to college?
Well, Green River was the world I knew, you know, and it was amazing the opportunities I got in that small town, because you don't have any, no one tells you, well, you can't be in three activities or you can't be president of all those things. If you have the energy and the desire and you work hard, you can be engaged in so many different things. So in a small town, there's a lot of opportunity. And a lot of times people think the opposite is true, mm-hmm. right? That there's no opportunity in a small town, that you're not going to get access to the things that you get in a big city. But when I went to college and I found out, oh, people said, oh, I couldn't play that sport and do that activity. We weren't allowed, or I couldn't do this and that because they were too far apart on campus, or I couldn't, you know, there were all these things that prevented them from engaging the way I got to engage. So I felt like it was an incredible gift mm-hmm. to grow up in Wyoming, but it also made me hungry for more. So as a kid, when I was being interviewed by Michael Crow at Arizona State, he said to me, "What were you thinking on the day that you graduated from high school?" Which I'd never been asked.
Right, that's an interesting question.
And I said, I was thinking how excited I was to get to know the whole world better. So I felt safe and comfortable in my world, and I still love Wyoming so much. It's so much a part of my heart. I wasn't actually born in Wyoming. I just grew up there. My dad used to say that I was his cowgirl daughter, and my sister was his Midwestern daughter. But I felt like it gave me this hunger to see things that I had read about and to, you know, and this is before the internet too. And so for me, it was
when we actually had to like pick up an encyclopedia.
Yes. And for me, it was this exciting adventure to go on, to get to learn the rest of the world. But I always wanted to be able to give back.
So what was it with your parents wanting you to go on to college? Or was that a conversation? And I ask this just frankly from my own personal experience. My mom had a college degree. My dad never finished college. But my dad was adamant that every single one of his children would have some type of higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just something that was ingrained in us from my dad, who had not had that opportunity.
Yes. So my dad was a brilliant man. He was a manual laborer his whole life. He was a miner and a large machine mechanic. He came home every day with dirt jammed underneath his fingernails so far he could never get it all out. I remember him standing over the sink scrubbing his fingernails. He didn't want his daughters to have that life. And he was so smart, he'd actually spent some time in some college classes. But he had to help with his family, and he had to work. He had no option. So he was determined that whatever it cost him, he would make sure that we went to college. So my dad worked double overtime, triple overtime, all the time. He worked endlessly, and I worked when I was in school so that we could make sure that I could get access to a college education. It was a very high priority to him. He said to both my sister and to me, "I want you to make your living with your mind." And it was such a gift that he gave me to do that extra work so I could get the education.
You know, I read the article with the Betsy Russell profiled on you, and you make this point in there about having that access, and that because you are a first-generation college student, because of the story you just told about your dad, how you can relate that to rural students here in Idaho. Talk to me about that, because as you are well aware, we have a 45% go-on rate. Our state board of ed wanted a 60% go-on rate by 2020. We're not going to make that. So now it's to 2025. It's not going to get there unless we have conversations like this about access.
That's right. And I think a lot of it is about thinking about how do we help students who live in rural areas understand the value proposition of what we bring in higher ed. Because if a student thinks it's not going to do me any good to get a higher education, I can't stay in my hometown, I'm not going to get to do anything meaningful, then they're not going to have any incentive to go on to school. And if their parents think their child is never going to come back and give back to the community that they all love, then that feels like a loss too. So what we've got to figure out is on both ends, how do we reach the student in the rural community, whether that student is a traditional age student or an adult learner? How do we reach that student? And how do we help them understand what we can give them? And then the reverse of that is also true. Once somebody is completing their degree, how do we help them figure out how they can give back in their home communities? Because many people are going to want to go home. But if they don't see being a college-educated self at home, then they're not going to go home. So we need to help them figure out how can they give back in their home communities while they're still in school? How can they show their home communities what they can bring? And I had an opportunity to tour a ranch and farm recently. And on that property, I was blown away by how much the person who was giving us the tour was talking about the incredible amounts of science and math analytics they were having to deploy to do the work that they were doing. And I thought, think of what having this person's sons get educated in those fields would do for their operation here. You don't have to hire that out if you've got homegrown talent. And so we can help supply that if we understand those communities well, if we're reaching out to them well. And so it really is a mutual conversation.
And I want to bring it back to some things I think that you're doing that are fairly innovative just on how you're communicating with people. And one of those is Twitter. You are very active on Twitter, whether it's, you know, a sunset or even the picture that you posted with the new University of Idaho president, Scott Green, when the two of you were in Cambridge together, or when you were at a Mariners game and you got to throw out the first pitch. What is it about social media that makes you so active and engaged?
It's so important for me to let people know who I am. So they got this interview process, and there are, of course, things that you can learn about me on the internet, but I wanted them to know who I was here in this context and what were the things I was going to care about. And so the easiest way to do that was to democratize it by opening it up on Twitter. And I'm very conscious that for a lot of people, a university president feels so far away. And so this was a way for me to step a little closer and say, I actually care about the things that you care about. I'm concerned about the things you're concerned mm-hmm. about. And here's a little story about that.
And, you know, beyond that, too, it does kind of open up an access because people can comment mm-hmm. or just like the picture that you posted. What's that like for you when you come to a new community? Because when you do read about you, there's very much a resonance of you care about every community that you're in.
One of the wonderful things about the comments has been an opportunity for me to see what people need. So a lot of times people will comment back to me and say, oh, it would be really great if you could come and do X, or it would be really wonderful if you would talk about Y. And so it gives me some sense of what the community needs, but it's also, I actually find it a fascinating study what things people like and what they don't. And I mean, which they click like.
Oh, right,
on,
right.
You know? And so there are, it's interesting to me right now with the following that I have, how much sports resonates with people. So when I hiked up Table Rock with the football team, man, that stuff got likes right away.
Oh, I'm sure, right?
Yeah. And I loved that opportunity. I got to walk up that you know, mountain with these young men where I could talk to somebody for 10 or 15 minutes and then walk up a little further and talk to somebody else. And, you know, yeah. I got to actually talk with some of the guys on the team. That really is important to me. But if people are excited about athletics, and for a university, athletics is often the way people come to know who you are. Mm-hmm. So right now, that's where most of my followers are resonating. But I think over time, there'll be a range of things they'll be interested in, you know, what we're doing academically. And it's not just football that they're interested in. Like, they were excited about Allie O and all of her successes mm-hmm. academically and athletically. But I think people will be more interested in what we're doing on the academic side of the house. And once we get the school year rolling again, we'll be able to start ticking off those accomplishments and things.
Let's talk about that, because when you look at the legacy that Dr. Kustra left, you know, 15 years at the helm of the university, and he took advantage of that athletic success and physically built up the university and has left a legacy in the sense of the buildings and the infrastructure. And now there's an opportunity to go even deeper into the academics. How important is it to marry the two?
Gemma, I think you've really hit the nail on the head, because I couldn't do anything that I will do in my term if Dr. Kustra hadn't done all the things he did. He did amazing things for the university and brought the university so far. So what I'll be doing next is building on what the work that he did. But what I can also bring as a lifelong academic is a very, very deep understanding of the academic enterprise, of the intricacies of research, of what's happening in the student-teacher environment. I've been teaching for 30 years. So that gives me a kind of insight and a passion for those things. Not that anyone who preceded me didn't have those, including Dr. Kustra, but that is a special experience to bring to the table here. So one of the things I'll be looking to do is to really find those people who share that passion mm-hmm. for the student learning experience, for the research enterprise, and to help people understand. A lot of people right now don't understand what the value of research is. Now, if you talk about cancer research, they say, okay, that I get. But if you're talking about basic science research or research in sociology or English or history or philosophy, they may not understand why that's valuable. And so I really have to help people understand that and find folks who are excited about that to invest in that, so that we can really grow that research enterprise, because the more research our faculty are doing here, the more positive impact we can make on the city, the region, the state.
That was Boise State University President Dr. Marlene Tromp. She joined us on Idaho Matters back in August. Now, after the break, we're going to return to the second half of our conversation with her. This is Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to a special presentation of Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We want to return to our extended interview now from August with the then new Boise State University president, Dr. Marlene Tromp. When she came into her position this summer, she entered a political firestorm. Before you even officially began at the university, there were a number of Republican lawmakers here in Idaho that sent you a letter questioning diversity and inclusion programs at Boise State. And we actually spoke with Representative Barbara Ehart, who wrote that letter to you, and then 27 other legislators signed off on it. And their big worry was that these programs would divide and segregate students. So you have actually spoken with some of these legislators. What has that conversation generated?
I think what it has generated is a new openness to dialogue. And for me, that's the most important first step. If we can sit down and talk with each other, there's a chance that we can understand each other's concerns better, understand the background better, understand why universities nationally have built such programs and why businesses have been so interested in universities creating such programs. But we can't have that conversation if people aren't willing to talk with us. And so even though there was a lot of dismay in the community, I think, from people who disagreed with that letter, I saw it as an opportunity to open a dialogue. And so for me, it's been wonderful to get to sit down and talk with people and share some things with them and hear from them and understand their concerns. And I think the next steps are really for us to just keep talking with each other and keep understanding the richness of what's happening at the university. Because Dr. Schimpf's letter was focused on a small sliver of our programming, because that's what the community, the university community, was asking about, I've been able to actually flesh out a much bigger picture for people about the kinds of programs that we have on the campus and also help them understand what the rationale is behind some of those programs. Now, that doesn't mean folks might not still disagree in the end about certain strategies or certain events, but we're already beginning to understand each other better.
And we asked for comments or questions, and we did get one. And in full disclosure, the Idaho Freedom Foundation tweeted us. Mm-hmm. And this is the question, and I'm going to read it verbatim. It says, can social justice programs and initiatives cripple academic integrity and achievement?
I think this is a question a lot of people are asking right now. And I think it's something we have to really think through seriously. I don't think we can dismiss any concern like this. I think we have to be very serious in our response. In fact, I think dismissing concerns when they're raised actually just shuts down the opportunity for us to engage. And we're intellectuals. A university is a place of dialogue and intellectual engagement. So we should intellectually engage. And I think the fear that drives that is the idea that somehow if we create a too cushioned environment for students, that they're not going to be able to survive in the walls beyond the university. And I think what we have seen ourselves doing historically is making sure that people who already were experiencing harm had some place where they could catch their breath again so they could engage more meaningfully and where they could get some support. And the metaphor I've used when I've talked with some others is, it would have been such a gift to me to know somebody else from Wyoming when I went to college, because I felt like I had an experience that was unlike anyone else's, and it was lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very involved in my undergraduate experience, but it would have been so wonderful to know some other kids from Wyoming. So I think it's partly about giving people that sense of small community so that they can participate in big community. But we never want to cripple our students or have them be hobbled by something that we're doing to try to provide care for them. So I think it's always worth having the dialogue. It's always worth having the conversation. And I think in some ways, the phrase social justice has become a laden phrase. People see it as being something that is diminishing or something that is, or some people see it as this grand and beautiful thing, and other folks see it as something diminishing or something that's a coddling.
Mm.
And I think we need to talk to each other about what is underneath the use of those words so that we all can get on the same page, because I can tell you that when I received that letter and started talking to people, what I discovered is a lot of those folks who I spoke to, their first words were, I really care about students. So we do have some common cares. We can identify what those are. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps us move forward together.
We had President Scott Green on the program last week, the new president of the University of Idaho. And he said one of the things he really wants to do is bridge the gaps between the universities. And historically, there has been tension between, in particular, the University of Idaho and Boise State, especially when it comes to money and the legislature. And basically going in front of JFAC every January and having to argue your case as to why you should get X amount of money. With that tension, how do you still bridge the gaps and really become almost one community?
In some ways, I think that's really, I think all of us who are presidents right now have a shared sensibility. When I tweeted a picture of Scott Green and me,
I think we were all shocked, actually, when we saw it.
And a lot of people wrote me back and said, don't ever do that. Don't ever go there. How could you stand next to him? In fact, when I stopped at the University of Idaho's campus in Moscow, when I went through, a lot of people tweeted me and said, oh my gosh, never set foot on that campus. And what I said to all those folks is, we have a shared mission, and that's to advance the state and to advance people in the state. And we are all, four of us, so clear. And in fact, all eight of us for all of the higher ed institutions in the state are so clear. That is our shared mission, that I think we will find those ways in which we can really be collaborative and cooperative. And it doesn't mean that there aren't going to be areas where we compete. But that competition shouldn't be destructive to the mission overall, and we are all so clear on that. And the state board is really invested in that, too. So I think we're all on the same page, and it's going to be a new era going forward.
You also have just a lot of boots on the ground work that you have to do.
Yes.
a lot of interim dean positions, an interim provost. How do you plan on moving forward with filling those positions, just the day-to-day grind of running a university, but then also implementing the goals and the visions of moving the university forward academically and research-wise, like we talked about previously?
One of the advantages of coming into a lot of interim positions, so there are challenges associated with that, but one of the advantages of coming into a lot of interim positions is that it really gives you an opportunity to shape that team. So I've got some wonderful leaders in place already, but now we're going to have an opportunity to bring in some new leaders. I don't have any intention of searching for the provost right away. Because when you turn over the two top executive officers, including the chief academic officer at the same time, that's very jarring for an institution. Tony Work is very knowledgeable, very skilled. He's been with the university for a long time. He came from a dean position where he'd served for many years. So he's a great person to have in that role right now. And what we're looking at is, where do we have the most urgent need to do searches right away? Because you don't want to turn over everybody at the same time and have everyone coming in.
It's jarring.
Yes. And an organization can only bear so much change at a time, and they've already just changed their presidency. So we're looking at each of those positions with care to figure out, where do we need to do searches right away? And if we're not searching right away, what's the timeline for that? And it's going to take me some time to learn.
What is it like as a first-generation college student to walk on a campus knowing that you are the president of that university?
Thank you for asking that question. It's the most extraordinary thing. I didn't even know when I was a kid if I would get to finish college. I had opportunities for track scholarships. I had opportunities to dance. I was a classical ballerina. I had opportunities to dance. I was afraid to do anything because I was afraid something would happen to me, like happened to my dad, that it wouldn't be about talent. It would be about the intervening life that would prevent me from finishing college. I didn't know if I'd ever get to finish. And when I started facing more and more obstacles and the money I had saved started running out, it was so scary. And I felt like I had to fight my way through. So I feel like it's this extraordinary gift that I get to do this work. And I never thought I would be an administrator. I thought I'd be a professor forever. I love teaching and research. But what somebody said to me early in my career is essentially what somebody said to Scott Green, which is, how many people do you want to affect? The students that are in your class every day or the entire community?
That was Boise State President Marlene Tromp during our interview back in August. Coming up next, we're going to revisit our conversation with the University of Idaho's new president. Stay with us for our interview with C. Scott Green. This is Idaho Matters, and I'm Gemma Gaudette.